We are now recording. This is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is
Abe. Hello, how are you, Aaron?
I'm doing well. I had a nice and fairly busy weekend here. I got to see Seven in the at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, which was it's pretty cool. Pretty cool to see. I've never seen it on a big screen before. So
that fantastic.
That was a fun watch.
On real film?
On no, because it's digital now, but it's still like it's new, like spanking new 4K trans, you know, that didn't like worked on, so it, like, it looks fantastic.
Yeah. So I figured, and it was like a giant screen, so, you know, when John Doe cuts off his fingers, you're just like, wow, his fingers are huge.
It is, because it's not like a real IMAX, but it's still a very big screen, because it's a big theater. So, like, that's why I wanted to see it there specifically, because it's just like there's a scope to that film that I think would work really well to see, like, with a crowd. So I thought that'd be fun. So,
nice.
It worked out well. It's
happened. Pretty packed?
It was pretty, for a 4 o'clock afternoon show, it was pretty packed. Yeah.
Okay.
We're there.
Great. Yeah, I've been hearing good things about folks' experiences on this special engagement.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. Not a whole lot happened except for the Warriors got blown out by the Sacramento Kings.
Obviously.
And it's just, this is a very, I'm feeling very distraught about it, I guess. Because, you know, the front office isn't doing anything. So, you know, Morning Talk Show Radio, like, we'll take our first caller here.
I mean, well, it's merely January, so I mean, there's like 17 months of playoffs that they can still maybe make it back up in, right? So.
Well, half. I mean, the All-Star break came in February, so it's already in the middle of the season. It's not looking great, especially considering that we keep on we win one, we lose one, we win one, we lose one. I talk as if I'm on the team, but
you're right there.
It's true, yeah. Steph Curry is my neighbor, so. I say hi to him and his kids and his family all the time. It's really, they're very warm and welcoming.
I call you Nicholson Mua just because I figure you're just like right there, like as a team player. Like, always.
It's weird. Yeah. Because like whenever they come out, I do put on a Jack Nicholson impression too. I'm like, hey, man, how are you?
It's weird that you shaved your eyebrows to match him, but I mean, it worked. So I can't.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't see it either, but you know, I'm just eating cheeseburgers every time that the Curry family comes out, just like Jack Nicholson and those famous sideline photos of him just eating.
You think, you know, who had the chunky soup ads? Which football player was
chunky
that?
Soup ads? A lot of them do. So,
but like, it was like him and his mother, like they were in the ads.
Well, it was supposedly his mother, but
I think who am I referring
to? Yeah, you're thinking about man, what, LaDainian Tomlinson?
It was LaDainian Tomlinson.
Well, it was one of them, because it'd be like, LaDainian!
Like, maybe eventually it was. You're right, there are like a bunch of them, that's the thing.
It's like, it's almost like every season they find somebody new. Like, this, I think in the last season they had the Kelce brothers.
From my perspective, this commercial only lasted from the early 2000s. that's when I cared.
Yeah, exactly. The only other person you know about from...
When I would still see commercials.
Right.
that's
like, the only other person that's in your reference is office linebacker Terry Tate from Staples.
Sure. Well, the reason I brought this up was, do you think Steph Curry's curry would be a good thing you should get into?
I don't think he should do that.
You don't want to see Steph Curry's curry?
I do not. As his business manager, I do not want to see that. It's not where we want to go right now. We want to focus on his basketball and his shoes.
What if he partnered with like a South Asian celebrity?
I wouldn't mind that. So if he had something like, you know, what's his face? Kumail Nanjiani, that'd be great. So let's go.
Nanjiani and Steph Curry's curry.
Exactly. I mean, that if it was a pop-up, maybe we could try that out in Oakland.
Nanjiani's nod and Steph Curry's curry.
You nailed it. Aaron Neuwirth, head of marketing.
We should probably get someone that's actually like living and currently in South Asia, as opposed to like an immigrant.
Right, yeah. But hey, you know, well known. And
we can get
also...
the two guys from RRR. We can get NRT Junior. or just go straight to the top. Get the director. Get him in there because he's a blast. Yeah. I still got to watch that. You know, there's an RRR documentary on Netflix now that I got to watch.
I did not know this. Oh. And also, did that movie come out 2 years ago?
That's 2022 at this point. Last year. So, 22.
Great.
It's going to play in theaters in LA at the end of the month. So I'm like, well,
35 millimeter at the Man's Chinese Theater. Well, that's actually TLC right now, right?
It's shot digitally. So
TCL. I'm saying TLC.
No, I love the No Scrubs Theater too.
Yeah. You know what you got to do when the lights go down? You got to creep.
Exactly. No, it's playing over at Vidiot's.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah.
Shout out to Vidiot's and all the listeners that want to go to Vidiot's to hang out with exactly. me and probably friend of the show, Jordan Grout, to see RRR. That's not the big screen.
Not a sponsor.
But I'm going to watch that doc, and that's going to get me so psyched up to be like, I got to see RRR. So I'm going to get really ready for it.
It's great. Well, that was Sports Corner.
Yeah. Out Now is a film podcast where Amy and I discuss new movies weekly. However, every now and then I have these special bonus episodes when it was for our fun commentary tracks, something completely different. This is not too different. It's just another main review and that's all episode here, because Amy and I want to make sure we get in some talk on some significant films before we do our top 10 show, which is coming very, very soon. And for this special bonus episode, we're talking Nickel Boys. This is the new historical drama that's critically acclaimed from director Romel Ross. And that's all we're going to do. So let's get to our main review for Nickel Boys.
It's been a long wait for some good news.
Good news, good news, good news. Things is changing.
Nana, what is it?
I let you down.
I'm okay, Nana.
Hell, I let you down.
No. No, I'm okay. I'm hanging in there.
Look back on it. Think back on it. It's a long time ago.
Hello. Where'd you come from?
My mother's watch.
Deck of marked cards. My big toenail.
That's all you got?
Really got nothing left to lose.
That should have been some of the trailer for Nickel Boys, based on the 2019 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead and inspired by a historic Dozier Reform School, a highly abusive institution that is still currently being investigated for a variety of heinous reasons. Nickel Boys focuses on the story of Elwood Curtis, a young black boy sent to Nickel Academy after being falsely accused of a crime in the 60s. Once there, he meets Turner, and the two of them form a close friendship, despite their opposing viewpoints on life. Together, they deal with the horrors of the school and its corruption. This film was co-written and directed by Romel Ross, an Oscar nominee for his 2018 documentary Hail County This Morning, This Evening. Abe, I want to know, what did you think of Nickel Boys?
It's a really good movie. It's quite effective in what it's doing. It's really neat in what it's doing, too. Something that we're just talking about is I largely knew nothing about this movie, except for the poster, which is a great poster, and it's a really good scene in the poster that they pull it from, too. But it is shot in the first person. And I was thinking to myself, oh, is this going to be shot from this point of view the entire time? And it's not. The camera switches to and from a couple of the main actors in this movie. And I thought it was pretty effective in what it was trying to do here. It's a little long, I think, to some parts. But I think that what they're trying to do here and tell a historical movie while also adding in true to life events, really, really well done. Like, to some parts, like, I almost thought that it was a documentary for what it was doing. Technically speaking, like, this cinematography is incredible. The color grading is also like fantastic, and I think that the score is also really good too. So good on everybody on the back end of doing this. But from the purposes of, or I'm sorry, for the points of view of the two characters here, it's tough because obviously you have our main guy, Elwood, who was just trying to walk to a school that his grandmother was like, you should go check out this school. Or one of his teachers, I should say, is like, you should go check out this school. And he's a smart kid. And he's very, he basically stays out of trouble. And it's kind of just very heartbreaking what happens to him. And then as you introduce some more folks here, I'm glad that they kind of give you a view into these other characters, whether it's like, you know, the kid who boxes or some of the bullies that that gets him. But then I'm glad that they kind of just focus on Turner and Elwood. When they do switch over to like the Turner point of view, I was kind of curious. I was like, what's happening right now? But, you know, you pick up on it pretty quickly. I thought it was pretty good, pretty effective movie. I wish it was a little bit shorter, but also at the same time, it is what it is.
This movie is set in Florida. And so in the words of Tramar LaSalle Dillard, a.k.a. Flo Rida, I want to say, oh, hot damn, this is my jam.
Keep going.
I love this movie. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's the kind of thing where you get a lot, you know, we see a lot of movies every year, and obviously there's larger ones and smaller ones.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of film that just makes me think I'm watching cinema right now. Like, yeah. I'm getting something that feels like an experience that is unlike anything else I've seen in the year. And there's a few movies I would apply that to that we'll talk about next week on the Top 10 show. But yeah, this movie just really worked on me. Like, I've seen this movie a few times now, and I walked out of the first screening and I was just like, what else can we do here? This is just amazing. At the time when I saw this movie, I had not read the novel. Since seeing this movie, I have now read the novel. It's very good. And Colson Whitehead was also responsible for The Underground Railroad, that book, which Barry Jenkins adapted to the Amazon Prime series,
right,
which I think is also fantastic and one of the best streaming series to come along yet. So I guess Colson Whitehead is just really good at making things that are worthwhile to adapt. It's like, I'm just completely on board with great filmmakers taking his words, which are very, I mean, it's The White Nickel Boys is a great book, and like, it's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Watching this movie, having watched it since reading the book now, it's like, it's a really good adaptation for one thing, like, beyond how closely it adheres, it just really seems to get what the novel's trying to do and turn that into something that works for film. But regardless of all that, yes, this film is spectacular. You mentioned the cinematography already. We'll talk more about all these things, but yeah. I think Joe Beaufray, the cinematographer here, he's developing quite a cool resume. I've seen a few of his films, including All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt, which came out last year, which is wonderful looking movie. Really calls to mind Terrence Malick, the kind of work that he does in his films. And that's a lot of what I get out of here, with the exception of obviously the unique aspect of taking the first person point of view, which is such a compelling way to tell this story. Like, I'll be curious what you think about this too, but like, it's, because you're seeing it from a point of view of Elwood and Turner, I felt more drawn in as far as what's going on in their world and like how they're experiencing the things they're experiencing in a way that made the film feel less about the pain of having to deal with such a corrupt institution and all this stuff, and more just trying to get inside their heads and like see their viewpoints on things and what they're trying to expect out of the lives. Like, there's just something there that made it feel like more than just another story about black pain,
which
I think is something Ramel Ross has wisely tried to do too, is just in general, like, the film's rated PG-13. So it's not trying to be like, here's all the horrible things shown in explicit detail. Yeah. It's like, that's obviously a factor of what this movie has to offer, but I think it's trying to explore more than that just deals with, you know, adolescence in this time period and what that means. And that comes through from the use of like stock footage of all these different things going on. And there's other elements we could talk about, but yeah, overall, I think this movie's fantastic, and the way it's presenting everything, I think, is just really interesting.
Yeah. To answer your question about, you know, my thoughts on the points of view for these two characters, I think it's also highly effective. I think that when you give like a regular, quote unquote, regular point of view on everything where everybody's on the screen all at once, you can kind of take a back seat sort of as an audience member. Right. Mm-hmm. But because it's first person and, you know, nothing like super egregious happens, meaning like you're not like, it's not as though like, you know, somebody's punching you and then like the camera like shakes. It's not a video.
It's not hardcore Henry.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's nothing like that. But the way that it does shift, and it does it very wisely too. Like, I'm thinking about the scene where Elwood's going to get whipped, and you're just like, well, it shifts from first person perspective into, you know, a more traditional camera setup for staging and blocking. But it is effective in that way. And also it really helps you focus on, again, just these two folks. And I think that that's much more of a more difficult feat to pull off. especially because you said that it's adapted from a book. So it is more difficult to kind of like write yourself in as this first person point of view. And the way that they pull it off, I think, is pretty good. So, yeah. Did you have more to expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, just to reflect on the book a bit, like, the book doesn't really, you know, it's not told in a way that would say, like, this is definitely the way to adapt it.
Sure.
So the fact that Ramel Ross is like, this is just the way that makes sense to me of how to make this movie, I found that really fascinating, because that doesn't make this movie easier to make, like, when you're doing a first person for anybody.
It's actually very hard.
From a direction standpoint, from a cinematography standpoint, from an acting standpoint.
Exactly.
You have these two actors, Ethan Hirose and Brandon Wilson, who I think are both really excellent, but, like, so much of the film relies on you following them from their perspective, meaning that you're not going to get to see key things happening to them directly, because they're in the viewpoint of them, which I think as an actor can't be an easy thing to, like, perform.
Yeah.
And I'm aware there's some stuff where they're literally wearing a camera on their chest.
Yeah, I was like, I can tell that there's, like, a rig.
There's a rig that, so it's actually, some stuff just doesn't involve them, but you still have the other actor performing at the camera.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. Because it's first person and you have actors that are interacting with your main perspective at the point, that means there's a lot of, well, you usually be considered fourth wall breaking, but instead it's just more of almost like a violation of the actor's code where they're just constantly looking at the camera performing at you, which, again, I can't imagine that being an easy thing to do, because you're basically taught not to do that as a performer, and yet you have to do that and emote and do it effectively without making it feel stagey. So, like, I'm very impressed by both these young actors who are fairly new to the game. So they've been in, like, smaller things here and there, but, like, this is, you know, a pretty, you know, they're the leads of this project, essentially.
Right.
But then you have other people like Anjanue Ellis, who ever since King Richard has just made some really excellent choices.
She's
popping up in movies I really like her in based on her, like, origin from last, the Ava DuVernay film, which I really liked last year. Or this, where she only has so many scenes, but they're pretty impactful scenes in this movie.
Yeah.
And she has to do that, like, you know, do the work that she's good at doing while, again, facing the camera. It's a tricky thing to ask somebody. And I give a lot of credit to Ramel Ross for being like, this is just the way we have to do this, and if I want to tell this properly.
Yeah, it's really I picked up on that too, because almost everybody at one point has to look down the barrel of the camera because they are addressing a person, right? And so you are, quote unquote, like that view of that person. So even like Hamish Linklater, who I just couldn't really buy, like, this is my own personal thing, where I was like, he's like an everyday guy kind of guy, and like in like The Big Short, he like plays like one of the quant guys. I'm like, I don't know if I could really take him as like this guy here, but, you know, it is what it is.
The only thing I did to do was add that mustache, like, oh, he's evil. I was sold right away.
And then we start taking off his rings, I'm like, well, this guy's gonna be a jerk. but everyone's looking down the barrel of the camera at one point or another, and, you know, you've seen this done with great effect too. One of the first movies that come to mind is like 12 Years a Slave, where you have toward the end of this movie, there's a shot where Chiwetel Ejiofor just looks at the camera for like 3 seconds, and you're just like, oh shit, like, he's kind of like looking here at the audience in present day. But all this to say is that it is very difficult, because I think from a craft standpoint, and I want to get more into like the plot elements here too in a second here, but from a craft standpoint, I thought about everything you're talking about too, which is, it's really hard as a director to, like, well, I don't know about hard, but it's difficult to plan out a lot of these things here, because, again, you have to show hands in a first person standpoint, but you can't make it look like it's oversized. You know what I mean? Like, you're trying to make it look regular size of a hand. So you got to work with your DP on a lot of these things. So good on them for thinking about all these things, because there was one point where Anjanue Ellis like pushes a cake. And the focus is, it starts out on like the part of like, you know, some of the cream and puff stuff. And then I don't know if it was supposed to focus on the strawberry, but it kind of focuses like toward the back of the cake. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the stuff is like very hard. And there's like some scenes in here where there's an overhead shot and a person is like moving their arm back and forth. And I was like, this is a very hard thing to do, because, again, movement with these lenses here is just like, you have to be very precise in what you're doing, and these things are imprecise. You know, these hand motions are just imprecise. So it's a difficult thing to pull off from a technical perspective. So good on them, because
And it's not an expensive movie either.
Do you know what the budget is?
It's like 20 something, which not nothing. But I mean, at the same time, it's like there's a lot of scope in this film, a lot of technical stuff that they're trying to pull off to make it work. And
yeah, agreed.
Doing it with without the luxury of a major studio, it's like some effort here.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to get into was that while you and I were talking a lot about, these two folks here, Turner and Elwood, and kind of how they are here at Nickel Academy or Nickel School. This movie is about America as well. You know what I mean? Like it's not just like these boys start to finish is just them at the school or, what happens after. It's mixed in with a lot of like what's happening in America right now, what is happening in like with the space race, President Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., assassinations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really it's not in your face about like, hey, by the way, this and this and this, it is painting a portrait of like there are different Americas for different people.
Sure. Yeah.
And that is a really like, again, it's not flashy. That's not what they're trying to go for in this movie. Like they're not like using that as like the main selling point, but it's very direct in what it's trying to say, which is like, even from the beginning when they're taking the car ride and then they like these two white boys are split up from like the black boy. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's just about how different, how again, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, I'm thinking about like Rodney King in the 90s, like even through now, in 2020s, like, there are still like multiple Americas, which is very fascinating to show on the screen. It's very hard to do that too.
Yeah. I think it's, again, with the uses of stock footage or whatnot, I like that it works as both a kind of a way to track the time that's passing, as well as, make some very interesting juxtaposition points for what it has to say without like you're saying, kind of directly slamming in the face with it, but also reflecting on like what the activity at the Nickel Academy is, what's going on there, and like how, and when you kind of widen out and prevent like a kind of a maximalist view of things, how you can show kind of all sides, and how you can show it from the smallest point of view versus like a large point of view, and do that in a way that, again, doesn't like emphasize how I guess what I like is that it's doing all this, and I never feel like it's a, like, I could see others thinking it's a downer. I didn't think of it that way as far as trying to communicate this information. Like, is it sad? Sure. Is it reflective in a way that doesn't make you feel the best about America? Yeah. Like, those are downer elements. But in terms of, I don't want to say like lecturing or schooling you, but it's certainly providing a, it's using this as an approach to speak to you in a manner that I think just does something informative about the experience here. So it's not just telling you the story of Elwood and Turner, which is obviously the focal point of the movie, but it has more in its mind. But in doing so, it's finding creative ways to accomplish those tasks. Yeah. And that, I think that there's a large benefit there, because you can tell just the straightforward story of what happens to these kids and how horrible it all is and everything.
Right.
Or you can find the greater points, which is what the book is doing, and what Rebel Ross is clearly interested in, as far as, he has a focal point for what to anchor off of, what you can build around as far as these characters and what have you. But there's more here to explore, but you only have so much time, and you don't want to be like this all-encompassing thing that you can't, becomes too ambiguous or too amorphous. So you want to be like, okay, like, let me, how could I approach that? And yes, I agree entirely with what you're saying. It's presenting this idea of what America looks like in the eyes of various individuals, and how that should be acknowledged more if there's any chance to kind of actually find progression that goes beyond ending Jim Crow South type stuff or ending segregation or this or that. Like, if you really want to like get to the core of what the issues are, I mean, you look at this movie and you look at the, I mean, as I mentioned, this is based on an actual school where there are bodies being dug up still.
That's right. Yeah. Like, it was a big, insane. It was a big article like a few years ago. There was a huge coverage on this as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these are true to life, horrific events that occurred here. And while the movie doesn't necessarily like, it's not dramatic in that way, it's not, you know, like, you know, the bodies are bare and the, like, the music swells kind of thing. It's more like, it's very matter of fact in what it's telling you.
Yeah.
And I think that matter of factness is actually what is most effective about it, right? Like, it's not trying to, like, it's not trying to sympathize with any of your feelings or, like, manipulate them in any way. It's actually just more like, hey, man, terrible things are happening here. People turn a blind eye to this, like, all the time. You know what I mean? And the thing is, like, what you were pointing out, too, is, like, this is happening to, like, children of all ages. You know, it's really hard to, like, watch this movie and just be like, oh, yeah, you know, like, these boys who are, like, 15, 16, 17. It's like, there are kids here that are, like, 8 years old. You know what I mean? And that's a crazy thing to think about. But it happens. And what I find very fascinating around about this movie, too, you mentioned origin. I kept on trying to think of like, other, like, boys' schools where there's, like, terrible things that happen. I mean, obviously not something like Dead Poets Society, but more of like real true to life type of things like this. Yeah. I feel like I'm forgetting like a big one, but
the closest I can think of is like Sleepers, which is like, okay, which is, that's the one where it's like the kids at, I guess it's New York, where they accidentally commit basically a crime that gets people hurt, and then they have to go to like a detention center.
This reform school.
Well, it's like an actual detention center, and like, and Kevin Bacon's a corrupt guard, and he rapes
Kevin
the kids.
Bacon. Jeez.
He's a corrupt guard. He rapes the kids, and then they grow up, and it's Brad Pitt and Jason Patrick and everybody. Yeah, like, and
other Rat Pack.
The other, yeah. And that, I mean, that.
No,
that movie was like famously kind of Oscar bait. Like, it's a big Barry Levinson movie and has a lot of big stars and everything. But it's, you know, I think it's based on a novel, but it's like, it's not rooted in much beyond, oh, that sucks. Like, this, you know, it's a movie about a bunch of white kids. Like, it's not really, it doesn't have much more to like expand upon beyond, oh, doesn't it suck that the system could be corrupt sometimes?
Yeah.
Where a movie like this, yeah, there's not a lot like it because, I mean, the thing we're saying is, I mean, we're still discovering stuff about this insane reform school that was horrible to all kids, but yes, largely the minority kids in there. And, yeah, those are untold stories. So there aren't going to be a lot of places of comparison outside of just like, you know, corrupt things that happen during like, you know, certain, I mean, to this extent and to the, you know, this degree.
Yeah. And a lot of the movies that even when you're mentioning the Kevin Bacon, there's two points I want to make. One of them is the Kevin Bacon thing is like, right when you mentioned Kevin Bacon, I thought about Murder on the First, which is, you know, him and Kevin Christian Slater kind of trying to go against like the prison system, especially like Alcatraz and kind of just how crazy it was there. And then another movie that is around, you know, atrocities happening within walls that is much more dramatic is also like The Shawshank Redemption, right? Terrible things will happen. But still, like this movie here, the other thing I want to point out that you just mentioned there was that you mentioned people of color. And I'm glad that you mentioned that because, again, this is not just happening to like young black men in America thing. There is a character in here that is like half Mexican. And he also faces a lot of his own challenges, too. They don't really dwell too much into it, but it is brought up. Right. So you're right that it's not just it because of the runtime and what it's trying to accomplish from a storytelling perspective. They probably can't go that into it. I'm curious, like, if that was ever brought up in the book, you know, all these other folks that are not black, but definitely not white either.
I mean, it stays its focus on Elwood and Turner. Like, there's additional color because it's a book, so it's longer. Sure. Like, there's more to kind of dig into to an extent. But, like, the narrative, like, keeps its focus pretty tight on specifically Elwood and whatnot. Sure. But yes, it's not without mentioning these aspects or what have you.
Yeah. I had a question for you because I had been pondering about this ever since seeing in the movie and kind of just like haven't really put my finger on it. But what was the symbolism of the alligator to you?
Oh, that's something I really like. It's hard to say this movie has magical realism in it because it doesn't really, like, because none of the characters really interact with anything going on there. But there's certainly kind of a side of the film that's fantastical in a way of, because we're seeing a point of view, we're getting instances of what's going on inside Elwood's head, specifically Elwood too, I think.
Sure.
Not Turner. Okay. And with the alligator, a real thing that happened was, you know, white farmers in Florida or whatnot, they would use black boys as bait to catch alligators. Mm-hmm. Like that happened because people were terrible. And I think the instances in which an alligator shows up, it's, I mean, I think it's just, it, you know, it's like, it's functioning in a way where like your mind is kind of like places random stuff that you know of at random, you know, sometimes just in your mind, you're just like, oh,
okay.
I was thinking about that. And I think he just knows this story about like how that's a thing. And in times of, I don't know, stress or heightened scenarios, I think that's just why it was just popping in there for him.
That happens in the book too?
Does it happen in the book?
If it does, cool.
I don't know. It's definitely mentioned in the concept of why alligators of using black boys as bait. That's definitely brought up in the book,
right? Okay,
I can't remember if it's like brought up as a, and then I saw an alligator. I can't remember like that specifically.
and the alligator was thrashing around.
But I already knew this thing to begin with, so like it's like, oh, yeah, I've heard about that before. But like seeing it in the movie, it's like, yeah, it seems like Rebel Ross has definitely wanted to like bring that out in a way, because it's just an evocative piece of imagery to throw in there all of a sudden.
Yeah, I couldn't quite pinpoint it, and maybe I'm thinking too hard about it, because I was thinking about the alligator. There's a couple instances of it happening in the movie, but then there's also instances of like a much smaller like gecko lizard kind of just like in a more innocuous space, whether that be like the boys actually like taming one of them, and then also when they're playing ping pong, it kind of hits the other one. But I couldn't quite figure it out. I'll probably have to think on it a little bit more, or read somebody's article about it and lift their work and put it my name to it. Plagiarism.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's always going to be an element of however you want to interpret it to be effective.
Right.
But it's certainly, it's a reflection of something Elwood actually, you know, knows about the time and like how it's coming into his mind. That's, you know, I think that can be determined up by the viewer. But that was my general take, that usually seems to occur when there's some form of stress happening with him, and it just kind of plops down in his head all of a sudden.
I want to ask you about the third act of this movie and kind of the end, obviously without going into spoilers. Curious your thoughts about where this movie goes. I guess to that effect too, like what you've been watching the whole time.
Frankly, I love what it's doing.
Okay.
Without getting too far into it, I love that it's doing something without you. It doesn't feel like there's an aha moment going on by the time like everything takes shape. It's just more of, oh, like I don't want to satisfy makes it sound too positive. Like, but I feel like a form of satisfaction comes from you understanding like, oh, this is what this is where things went.
Sure.
And I think it's quite effective in how it does that. And I'm sorry to keep like referencing the book, but like,
no, please.
It is. I do. Having seen the movie first and then reading the book, I was like, I was curious, like, so how's the book going to play this out? And it does. It does so in a way that's, it's more dramatic, I would say, in the book, given just how things are presented.
Yeah.
Where in the movie, it's like, by the time you're getting to understanding certain things, like, oh, that makes sense, I guess. Or like, it doesn't feel like it's not trying to give you any whiplash by doing certain things. All of that in mind, I love the final like 10 minutes of this movie. That's just a basically a very long montage.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's set to this wonderful jazz track, that I think is just a fantastic way of communicating a lot of information for you without just saying, you know, just not, without the characters like directly addressing the camera and telling you what happened. I think there's a lot of information that's trying to be presented that reflects both the main characters of the story as well as the overall arching narrative of the story, as well as what's going on with Nickel Academy. To wrap a film up in the way it does, I found that to be quite. I was, you know, you're sitting in this movie for, you know, nearly 2.5 hours, and I can agree that it's like maybe a bit long, but especially having watched it multiple times, it doesn't really bother me anymore. But like you're basically going on a such a long journey, and so by the time I got to this end point, or you know, this just kind of not dragged out, but like extended end point that's kind of giving you everything to kind of close you off with, that was just really, I thought it was really powerful, honestly. I just really appreciated that. How about you? What'd you think of kind of where the story goes and everything?
I think powerful is the right word. I think the way that I was thinking about it too is that it essentially ends on a very hopeful, empowering note.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
because of what is, like, again, I can't speak directly to it. I'll talk to you about it off air. You know, the way that I view it is like, we won, you know what I mean? Like, or specifically like, you won, you know what I mean? your legacy secure kind of thing, right? And we will continue to work on this, right? And again, it's not flashy in what it's trying to say or do. It just is still, again, quite matter of fact. I agree with you that the montage is quite effective in what it is doing. And I think, like, when you think about that, like, again, transplanting myself out of it, kind of thinking more beyond, like, the movie and kind of just thinking about it, like, real-world stuff. Like, the erasure of human lives, you know, at young ages in the history of this country is, like, it's pretty sad. And kind of just seeing on these photographs or seeing, like, Social Security cards or, like, I really like the... like the vignette videos of that kid who's like doing like cool stuff with like with video camera stuff where he's like cutting himself in and out or like going behind mirrors and kind of just doing this, that it's like all this, you know, possibility is just extinguished. And that was kind of hard to kind of think about. But yeah, I like the ending of this movie quite a bit. It actually picks up quite a ton for me. And then it has this compelling narrative, but also like it, I think it actually really sticks the landing as well.
By the way, as far as characters involved towards the end, Fred Heschinger once again, Craven, Gladiator, Thelma, Nickel Boys. This yeah. kid is everywhere. Nice young man. Talk to him with the Gladiator feeling. He's a very nice guy.
Yeah. He seems like he's our height too. So
he's about our height. Yeah.
He's having a crazy year. Like I thought about that too. Yeah. I was like, "Oh, is that Fred?" It's like he's had three major releases, and you mentioned Thelma. I was like, "Hey, this is Thelma."
Yeah, so, he's all over.
Jeez, yeah. You know, like great on him for just being like for his agent and him kind of just strategically saying like, "Let's just release him on 2024.
Do this. It's our year. You're Fred."
Exactly. Yeah.
But he's a little shit.
Joseph Quinn guy. Fuck him. Like we're gonna be the winners this year.
He's a little shit. This movie, dude. He's the worst kind. Where he's like, he'll be like, make it seem like you're his friend. But the second he can take a turn, he will. What else? What else about this movie? Sounds great. The
sound,
the score.
Oh, so score. I agree. Yeah,
the score by I see Alex Sommers. I assume Havoc himself and Scott Ilario.
Wait, is it really by that guy, or is his name just Alex Sommers?
His name is Alex Sommers. Not S O M M E R S.
At first, I was like, "Oh, the guy he left acting to become a composer." Incredible.
Oh yeah, so it is. It's not what's his name? Lucas something or other.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, we need to know this.
Yeah, I was like,
Lucas Till.
Yeah, Monster Trucks Lucas Till?
Lucas Till. Yeah, he was ready for Creech. But no, it's good. It's a good score in this film.
Yeah.
And the sound. Yes, the sound is also good.
That was good, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but the score it's quite good at what it's doing. So
it's all without being like overwhelming, I thought.
Correct.
Like,
yeah.
There's a way to do this kind of movie where things can swell and be very big or what have right. you. I think there's a lot of subtleness to what's going on here.
Yeah. I want to ask you about this, which is just, again, I mentioned this earlier. We kind of focus more on Turner and Elwood. You kind of get snippets of the other folks, but did you think that we needed more of the other folks, a little bit less of the other folks, or more of anything else? Like, where were you on like the weight-o-meter?
It's a good question because like early on you have our boy Jimmy Fails from the last Black Man in San Francisco as the teacher, the high school teacher.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where it's like, hey, I know who that is. That's the guy from Black Man in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And we don't get more of it. We get, you know, a couple scenes and he's gone. Yeah. I already mentioned Angelus Taylor, who's very good in this movie. He's in a couple scenes. That's it. We get some of the other boys in here, including one of the guys that's in the show Shrinking, who plays like the main boxer in this movie. Mm-hmm. Good actor. You don't really learn much about him. Yeah. I'm saying all this because I don't think I need more of this. I think the movie is doing a good job of presenting you characters that seem interesting, that seem like they have their own stories that could be interesting to follow or whatnot. But I do think the movie does itself a service by saying, no, we're focused on Elwood and Turner. We want to see this friendship. And just to add, the book doesn't have more because it's from their perspective as well.
Right.
But No, I think it's a case of, yeah, there's good casting done to get a number of like recognizable players in here so you can kind of relate to what's going on in the story by recognition of the various people that are going to keep popping up. But yeah, in terms of, you know, compared to something like a Shawshank, where it's like, let's take a 10 minutes and go follow what's his face outside the prison once he gets out with his bird. it's like, I don't think we really need like separate vignettes to kind of give us more of a picture of what's going on here. I think the film itself is already doing that by one thing, the kind of the archival footage and the flash forward stuff that comes into play as well. I think it would just overcomplicate itself if it tried to kind of delve too far into other people.
Yeah, I agree. I think the reason why I asked is because sometimes I felt as though there was a little bit too much exposure on some of these characters as well already. And I was like, well, you know, I don't need to know that there was like internal bullying going on, you know what I mean? Or that he was scared to be there. Like Elwood is scared to be there because he's like this new kid and he's been a straight edge for his whole life kind of thing. And I don't know if I necessarily needed to like, you know, find out about boxing matches or whatever else. Like, it's interesting to see. But also the way that it the way that feels sort of out of place to me is just from the standpoint of everything is so like what I was using earlier. The word is like matter of fact. And everything else just feels like it's like dramatized. You know what I mean? And so that part is like, well, you know, I appreciate them showing me this, but I kind of just like them, you know, painting a house and just being like, this is such bullshit. Like we could make this a 3-day job if we wanted to. And also like this white lady here, don't believe her. She's actually part of the problem too. You know what I mean? And that stuff is much more fascinating to me than like, oh, let me go bump this kid in like the hallway. You know what I mean?
I would say I'm more compelled by, yes, the Elwood Turner dynamic as far as seeing them, you know, relate to each other, relate to how the real world works and what those point of views are. And we do get a lot of that, so it's not like I'm lacking in it.
Right.
I will say there's more boxing in the book. That's even more.
Oh,
it's funny you mentioned that, because that's even more of an element in the book. Yeah. They cut it down. And I mean, I hear you as far. I feel like that just comes from us seeing a bunch of movies as far as like seeing other kids bully Elwood or what it's like.
I'm not saying like it's super detrimental, but it's just
I know what you're getting at as far as, is it annoying to see these guys? It's like, it's also like, that happens. So you're like,
Like, it's just more of I kept on trying to get a keep tabs on like, okay, well, this is that kid that did this or this is that kid did that. But it actually doesn't really amount to a whole lot because it's just faces in the crowd kind of thing. Maybe that's what they intended to be. There's something I wanted to kind of just like throw out there. Something that I thought about, you know, with sort of like a double feature to this, not necessarily like double feature because it's like a huge thing. It's like The Wire season 4.
The kid season.
The one about the school system. And it's like, see how that stuff transpires like even today, right? You know, how like there's the generations of, you know, misappropriation of, you know, bad deeds has kind of like still transpired and is still present today. And it just reverberates. And how do you break out of these things kind of thing?
Yeah. It might be obvious, but like Moonlight, obviously, I think shares a lot in common with this film for sure. I mentioned Malick already as far as Gilmore Frey's cinematography, but like, other Malick, like Tree of Life is, you know, I mean, if anything,
it's one first thing that a lot of
Tree of Life's a wonderful counterpoint because we already mentioned these kind of two Americas, and Tree of Life is nothing. There's no strife in Tree of Life involving involving those boys and their upbringing beyond the familial element they're just, you know, they're white kids in the suburbs. Like, there's not a lot that's going to challenge them outside of the regular challenges of life at that point, not to undermine the idea of challenges, but, you know, it's certainly like their struggles are not nearly as deep compared to just because they look a certain way, they're being thrown into a reform school.
Sure.
Like, so, but as far as skidding 60s Americana, you can easily put these films next to each other and kind of see those Americas in action and see filmmakers that are very contemplative about those things and how plus the flashback. I mean, it actually is really similar if you think of it in the kind of from a structural standpoint. The Tree of Life is absolutely saying a lot of things about life as opposed to like just the civil rights movement or whatnot, but it's expanding itself out to tell a larger story in addition to telling the kind of the quieter story of the
And I think one of the things I like about Tree of Life is that it's not necessarily about like it's a movie about realizing your faults and failures as a person, and then expectations on your children kind of thing. And what I think that you're kind of right about is that Brad Pitt's a white guy. And you know what? White people are supposed to be like, I got everything under control. And like, he doesn't. And it kind of falls through to his son, Sean Penn. And that is difficult. And it also is difficult on his wife in that movie, played by Jessica Chastain. It's about, it's really cool that you just put those two together. It's like, these are two Americas. And again, imperfect, right? And that's a very accurate way to depict a lot of things.
That's also what makes Terrence Malick a great filmmaker. The fact that, yes, he could say Brad Pitt is this guy who has a job and a family and kids. He's succeeded, right? No, he hasn't. No. Like, he feels terrible.
Watch the movie and you'll find out that he's an alcoholic, drunk, abusive guy. Yes. And he's actually a terrible father. true to life.
The film does keep making references, visual references to the Defiant Ones, this old movie with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis.
Yes.
Keep seeing that movie kind of occur throughout the film. For one thing, I recommend it wholeheartedly. It's a very good movie. I want to say funnier than it, but you know it.
Funnier,
I'm not going to say it is funnier, but like it is Poitier and Curtis being like, oh, we've been chained together, we're on the run.
Mm-hmm.
There's inherent humor that comes out of that, in addition to being a film very focused on, you know, the racial differences between two men like this that are stuck in a situation. But it's another one that I'm sure Romel Roz is like, I clearly must have a certain love for that movie. He's going to feature it so heavily throughout his film.
Yeah.
I did find that to be interesting.
Yeah. It's really funny just the way that the screen comes up and I was like, are we watching something else right now? Like, because it has like the title.
It presents like the title.
And I was like, What just happened right now? Like, is this movie, because it happens early in the movie, I was like, are we just all of a sudden going to like have them pretend to be Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis? And I was like, it's not what happens. It's just, again, portrayals in Hollywood, I suppose.
I'm really looking forward to you seeing The Brutalist as well, speaking of kind of movies that are about America.
Really looking forward. Yeah.
Because I do think these are not one-to-ones at all, but I do think that's another movie that kind of complements this film as far as just presenting you different eras of American time and like what kind of struggles certain kinds of people were going through.
Yeah.
While also, you know, just being cinema as far as its presentation goes.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's releasing in the Bay next week in a couple art house theaters. Not art house, but like smaller chain theaters, but still they play some art house up. I have a question for you.
They're playing it in IMAX by me. Like, just to show you.
What are you saying? I should fly down?
Yes.
Okay. I had a question for you. What are your thoughts in general about kind of interspersing real historical news events into movies?
I think if you're going to do it, you better be confident that you're using it for the right reason.
Okay.
I think there's plenty of movies that can do something like that and not quite feel like they've nailed the appropriate tone to be or earned that kind of element. I think of a lot of biopics some try to creatively deploy their actors and put them into real life scenes or whatnot, where others just like show you footage of stuff that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
A movie like this, I think it does rather effectively because as we've established, there's a sense of trying to communicate to you what's going on in these times and how are we catching up with these characters and at what point and when and what's happening in the world while people are dealing with certain things. So I think it really applies in that manner. I'm trying to think of other like examples.
I mean, a lot of folks do it, but again, it's effective here. And again, gives it kind of like a documentary feel to some degree, but yeah, if you're going to use it, I generally am a fan of it. You know, the movie like Moneyball does this too, right? Where all of a sudden, like you splice into like the real AL it's not the championship series, but the AL division series or something like that versus the Twins, or like their 19 game win streak and some, or 20 game win streak. And it's incredible to see. It's, it, it really adds like a layer of, not really fourth wall breaking, but it kind of just, again, helps put you in a time and place. Adam, what's his face, does this all the time too. The guy who made,
Adam McKay.
McKay. Yeah. Cause we just talked about, The Big Short, or we talked about the Linklater and The Big Short.
I think that's one where he's certainly riding on a confidence to be able to do that. Where, sure. Like, The Big Short's a film that's so stylized as far as presenting you a lot of information and trying to do so in a way that's communicative to the average person. So the fact that, yes, he's also just throwing in like all this stuff that relates to, like, you know, the financial crisis or what have you, let alone his other in Vice, or sure. even the end credits of the other guys, like there's, you know, if whether or not you feel it's done effectively, because I know The Big Short, as much as I like it, I do think it has a lot of people that are not as fond of that movie. I do think he's using things in a way that feels very much confident on his part to earn those. I think it's less effective in Vice, for example.
Sure.
I don't think it adds up to a whole lot by comparison. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I agree. Cause it can be, even in The Big Short, it can be like used in a way that is like just like, okay, well, it's storytelling and then you're kind of showing me what happened, but it's also not ultra interesting to some degree because we live through it. For something like this, for Nickel Boys, I did find it pretty fascinating, you know, the articles, or, you know, it's actually less on the Nickel Boys / whatever real name academy it's actually called, but more on the Americana stuff, you know what I mean, whether it's like NASA, the moon landing, the Martin Luther King's speeches, Martin Luther King's funeral, like seeing like Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier like in film and stuff like that. That stuff is like very effective. So just here's your thoughts on it, because again, it has been used. It's not anything new, but I thought that it was used well here.
I certainly feel the same way. Were you caught? I mean, I'm sure you probably were. Like, what'd you feel about the kind of the flash forwards that take place in this movie? The fact that we kind of move out of time during certain instances.
I dug it. I think it actually helps break up the movie, because otherwise you would just really be stuck in this whole entire, like, well, what happens? You know what I mean? It's like, it's telling you these things in flash forward / piecemeal ways, but at least that kind of helps to keep some of the engagement going. I'm not saying that it's a boring feature by any means. It's more that if you were just to start out with him doing all this stuff here as like this child, high school child, and then going into the Nickel Boys Academy for the duration of the movie, and then it kind of just ends in a very traditional way of like, great, well, you know what? He got out, and this is him now. It's like, it would not be as effective as what it portrays here. And it also actually doesn't lend itself to the third act of what you and I talked about, like, you know, 20 minutes ago, because I think that actually would be like, it actually would just wouldn't have worked for me if it was like very traditional.
If it was all like moved towards the, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, if it was just like, great, you know, like, and this is what happens, like, okay, well, the way that it happens here is that I was just like, I think I was much more invested in the way that it's devised here.
I think you're speaking to something that the film does such a great job is, which is not losing track of our points of view, which is Elwood and Turner. It's one thing to introduce certain elements that can inform you on what's to come or what have you, but because of the editing choices being made, because of the cinematography, obviously, as far as continuing that theme of the point of view while kind of adjusting it based on what time we're in.
Yeah.
There's so many ways where this movie could have made the wrong choice, starting with not using that perspective, because you just get more of a traditional, look how sad this all is, and here's what happened to this guy, and here's what happened to this guy, and et cetera, et cetera. And I've seen, I mean, is there a good movie that can come out of that? Sure, I've seen that movie before, though.
Yeah.
This movie, I haven't seen this movie before, you know, even while mentioning something like A Tree of Life or whatnot, where it's thematically similar, or at least thematically, you know, there's a parallels that you can find between them. Just the very presentation of this film, I found to be so fascinating and wonderful. Like, as far as giving me something that just, you know, is telling you a specific kind of story, but doing it in a unique way.
Yeah. I think just to add on to the final point there, it has a use too. Like, it's not as though the third act happens. And again, the non-traditional linear, unlinear pathway of the storytelling is super informative and helpful, or is super helpful, but it is informed by the story. Therefore, at the third act, when all the cards are on the table, I found the use of the camera placement to be very, it's not a metaphor. It's just more of like, it's very, to me, purposeful, right? Sure. It's purposeful because of what happens to characters in this movie. And therefore, it's like, it's a shift in perspective because of who the person is at that point in time. Because this happens like during a hug sequence too. You are seeing a very deliberate placement of a camera during a hug sequence in the beginning of the movie, and then also in the third act of this movie. And again, it's very deliberate. So to me, like, if you had just made this linear, and I'm sorry that I'm being like super like vague and everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's like, it's more that I can't tell you because it would give super a lot of things away, but I found it to be very cool from a storytelling perspective. It's almost like a ghost to some degree. So it was really cool.
Honestly, that's another one I thought of too. David Lowery's A Ghost Story. I think that movie came to mind. Obviously they're very different movies, but in terms of like, because of the journey that Casey Affleck as a ghost character goes through, there's something reflective about kind of seeing the world around you advancing as you're stuck in a situation.
Sure.
That I think plays into what Nickel Boys is after as well, where the difference being Affleck, your ghost, whatever the fuck, it's like, it's basically a non-entity that's observing, where Elwood and Turner have very clear perspectives on what they think about the world, and you're seeing that evolve over time or what have you as well. So you obviously it's more, you know, there's more introspection and whatnot, as opposed to just he's in a sheet, he doesn't say anything. I mean, there's only so much you can really glean out of this.
He's trying to carve through a door wall to get to the final note his wife left him. So and it's a great movie. I love A Ghost Story.
How was the pie? That's what it said on the note.
And then he finally figured it out and he can finally like, move on. Yeah.
Crunchy. What?
I like to think that it was much more of like a joke. Knock, knock. Who's there?
It says what Bill Murray said to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Incredible. So,
which was, you can use the restroom in my room. I think that's
what he said. I think when in closed captions. Yes. What did you think of the format of this movie?
The 1-3? The ratio?
The ratio, yeah.
What I find interesting about what we've been seeing in the past 5-10 years now at this point is that filmmakers very much seem to like to play with the ratios in a manner that I think could be dismissed as artsy or my least favorite term outside of overrated, which is, which I can't think of right now, what's fucking, pretentious. Two of my least favorite words, pretentious and overrated, because they're never used properly. Uh-huh. One just doesn't even make sense to me to begin with. But regardless, but instead, what I'm choosing to view a lot of, you know, especially indie filmmakers or what have you, by making these specific kind of ratio choices or what have you, is we're over a century into filmmaking. I mean, there's only so much you can do to convey certain types of emotions or certain types of things without, you know, being James Cameron and inventing new technology. Sure. And so I think the idea of filmmakers that have clearly studied film, you know, have an interest in the formats for obvious reasons, they're filmmakers, and want to, you know, look at the choice being made, whether it's black and white or ratios or what have you, and say, you know what, if there's a better way to express what my characters are going through, I feel like, you know, shrinking the frame down so I can get these close-ups to matter in a way that feels separate from a widescreen portrayal or what have you.
Yeah.
I think, you know, depending on the movie, of course, I think the I'm all for those kinds of choices. Do I like get more excited because, like, you know, a movie starts and like the masking suddenly changes, so like it fits the ratio?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. But if that's happening, if there's a conscious choice being made to say, I want the frame to be smaller so we can focus in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
I want to watch the film and see that explored. I want to see why they made that choice.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sorry for making a long way around to get to the answer to this question. But in terms of using that for this movie, I absolutely think it makes sense because of, for one thing, the first person perspective, it's already making it more intimate in a way that's, I don't know, somewhat indescribable. But but in terms of giving you that kind of focus and clarity, I absolutely think that makes a lot of sense, kind of narrowing your vision, so you can have more of a, when Elwood or Turner are talking to each other or other characters, you're locked in. When the character's talking at you, you're locked in because the frame is very much directing you to feel a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
Which again speaks to how difficult this movie feels like it was to make, to convey so much effectively, because you could do this and it could also not be critically acclaimed and get nominations for things and have, you know, pretty widespread universal acclaim for what's going for. But no, it worked for me, at least it worked out.
Yeah.
What do you think of the choice?
I liked your answer. I think you hit it, which is a director can choose whatever they want to do. Right. And this is how he wanted to shoot this movie. Ramel Ross wanted to shoot this movie and he did it. And I think that it does help out too, like what you're saying, from a POV standpoint, from these characters. I think one of the things that this is just a nitpick, personal nitpick, but it's like everything's like in bokeh, like he's using like soft focus on the background kind of thing. So it's like, well, a human eye doesn't really do that, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Still. It's a personal choice.
We also don't see crocodiles all the time, or alligators all the time. Alligators.
But it's a choice, and I like when directors make choices. I think that that's one of the big things that I have advocated for, like in this podcast, and you do it as well, which is like, make a choice, stick with it. You know what I mean? Like, do something weird. It's fine. Because I'd rather see that than like something that is like, very much like out of the box kind of like feel. I think the other thing that about the, point of view, or this is a soapbox moment for me, but just more of like, I don't like the Instagram reels or TikTok reels, the one that were like, what if this was shot in vertical? It's like, I don't, that's not how the director shot it.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
I don't give a shit about
started on the AI recreations of things and all
exactly. It's like, I was like, I don't give a shit about like how a field looks much more like, you know, incredibly when like it's when you see more of it and more of the sky, it's like, this is not how the director shot it. So I don't want to see that stuff. So box over. I think the last thing I'll say about like the 4-3 or the 1-3 aspect ratio and stuff like that is like, I think back to the Fablemans and when Spielberg or Sammy is talking to David Lynch's character, and he's like, make it interesting. You know, if the horizon is in the middle of the screen, it's boring. If it's in the top, it's interesting. If it's at the bottom, it's interesting. Make it interesting. And you know that 1-3 makes it interesting.
Entirely agree. And I'll always take joy in thinking of David Lynch playing John Huston.
with an eye patch smoking cigarettes in front of like a 15-year-old kid. Yeah. 17.
What else? what else can we talk about?
I think I just want to ask you,
John Ford. Sorry, it's David Lynch.
John.
I said John Huston.
John Huston.
John Ford. John Ford. Yeah.
But I want to ask you about award possibilities here.
Oh, I mean, I'm hoping that it gets the most recognition possible, which I would say would be picture, director. Those would be, as it stands, I think those are likely things. There's a crowded field, but it's certainly in the running. It's got a lot of acclaim. It's got a lot of love. So that's, you know, happy to see that.
Yeah.
Jill Frey cinematography, that's easily going to be in the conversation.
It's going to, if it loses to Wicked, I'm going to like throw my chair at my TV.
I'll be in like, there's so many good cinematography choices this year. And so if one has to sit out for other movies that, I think are very obviously not as good, I will be annoyed. But I think Joe McFarlane
cinematography is a very diplomatic way to say it.
I think that's good odds on for.
Okay,
we're talking like Oscars. Like we can talk plenty about like other awards and stuff.
No, yeah, it's gonna get nominated in like in
far as those. I think Anjanou Ellis-Taylor is in a good spot to be a supporting actress. At least he's in contention for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I do think that. Pretty crowded this year. It's always pretty crowded, but I do think there's certainly as far as like the acting representation, that's the one that they're pushing the most. She's already a nominee, and you know she's kind of a representative of the, you know, an adult representative of the films that speaks well in that regard.
Yeah.
Screenplay adaptation, I assume, would probably be a factor in there. I mean, it's adapting a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, so that's, you know, not out of the realm of consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Editing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, yeah, as far as the technicals go, it'd be like cinematography, editing, screenplay, director would be, those are in the cards. Yeah. There are plenty of other films that will also be, you know, trying to play the same hand.
Totally,
We'll see where it goes.
We'll see where that goes.
But the film is, there's a lot of unanimous praise for the movie, so we'll see.
I've seen it on a lot of top 10 lists that I've seen so far, but I wasn't sure about where it's, standing was from the Oscars. I mean, this harkens back to our discussion about Night Bitch, and I was just like, Aaron, what are the trades saying about our gal Amy Adams? You're like, it's kind of DOA.
Yeah,
like
Paris of that movie's, that movie's DOA at this point.
Yeah, because she is great in the movie, but I'm just like, I'm bummed because, you know, but yeah, I'm glad to hear because that'd be a big win if it got nominated in Best Picture, Best Director. I think that'd be like a huge accomplishment.
Director would be, that's, you know, that there's a long list.
That's tough, yeah. It's a pretty good movie but year from that perspective, especially
when it's getting late. And it's a smaller film, and as we've seen lately with directors, the International Board has really made a strong play to get international directors more recognition when it comes to those nominations. So, like, that puts Ramel Ross, I think, lower in that category. That said, maybe things rally. It's still a little early in the award season as far as what, like, right now, I don't see a front runner. Like I
for
like,
which category?
For just like anything, you know, just like what's the movie that you can't like?
Kieran Culkin. We're talking about best supporting actor.
I mean, you can honestly kind of as far as what's likely going to happen. But as far as like the movie that you can't stop, like last year was Oppenheimer.
Easily. Yeah, yeah.
Like we all were like, well, that's going to win, and it did. I mean, there was no real questioning. Sure. It didn't really break out of there this year. Like there's movies that certainly have a lot of steam, like Anora, The Brutalist, even Dune to an extent.
A lot of technical sub below the line.
Technicals for sure, but in terms of like what's the conclave, I guess. Like I don't know.
That's
like,
true, yeah.
There's not one movie that's like this is the top of the pile, it's gonna clean up. That's not really happened as of yet.
So. Yeah.
Which that makes me happier as far as the potential for something like a Nickel Boys, among other films that I also really like, that could potentially be in that conversation. But you know, we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I was not loving all of the Wicked talk when it was released and people were like, best actress, best picture, best director, best, you know, cinematography. I was like, this is
Wicked's Barbie. Wicked's in the Barbie spot. Wicked is popular and it will be nominated for certain things, but it's not going to go any distance.
Yeah, I'm glad that it has trailed off because I was just not having it, and I was like, I can't believe that people are bypassing things like this, like Nickel Boys, or again, you know, a better shot movie is also like Anora as well, but yeah, like smaller movies, so to speak. I want to ask you,
don't be too loud about this because next year we'll have our top 10 show, and I mean, I know we'll be, I'm very sure it'll be on Mark's top 10, but Mark
Wicked is, chapter 2?
No, chapter 1.
Oh, chapter 1.
For our top 10 show next week. I know, I'm very sure, I don't look at anybody's lists before we do our show. I'm pretty certain Hoban's going to have it on his. Marcus, who knows? It could be his fucking number 1. I don't know.
Could be. I had a question for you, but I forgot it. Yeah, it's all right. So. Nickel Boys, go see it.
Nickel Boys is currently playing in theaters. When should people go and see this movie? I think you just said go see it.
Yeah, I think you should go see it. I think it's worth a theater experience primarily because of all the technical things that you and I've talked about. Right from the jump, like, again, beautiful color. Like, it's a saturated color. I forget the actual term for it, but the color scheme. Color grading. It's quite saturated in what it's doing here, but it's effective. So, yeah, go see it.
It's a, I mean, outside of like the unique approach to the cinematography, it's a great looking movie. I agree with you. Like it presents this very specific area and time in the South in a way that, yeah, it speaks to the kind of the harshness of the reform school. I keep wanting to say prison, but the reform school they're in. But it's also, I think, a very warm film. It has a lot of expression in its color palette and what have you.
Ingenue Ellis's dress when she first meets Turner is like incredible. You know,
there's a lot of touches like that for sure. Yeah. That
it's like it's so it pops, and I was like, I wish I had seen this on the big screen.
Well, yeah, I completely agree. See this movie as soon as you possibly can, because movies like this only get to play for so long. Although if it gets more awards recognition, it'll certainly stretch out its theatrical run. But Yeah, if you can see it on a big screen, go see it. If you can't, it's an Amazon MGM movie, so it'll be on Prime at some point very soon. Watch it then. Then look at your phone and be like, oh, I should have listened to Aaron and Abe and watched the movie in the theaters when I had a chance.
There you go.
But yeah, Nickel Boys, fantastic movie. We recommend it heartily.
Last question. I remember it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What do you think of the Orion logo? I know that it's been a few years, but what do you think of the Orion logo?
I think it's fine. It's very shiny now.
I miss the old one.
I miss the
old
one.
Give me the RoboCop Science of the Lambs Orion logo, where it looked like it was like a planet shooting a laser beam out.
To bring this all around full circle, seeing Seven yesterday, you get the classic New Line logo right at the beginning of the movie, which was great. It was great to see.
There's a new New Line logo?
No, it's the old. It's the classic New Line logo. You get to see the old. But I'm seeing it like on a giant fucking screen. I can't remember the last time I saw like a New Line movie with the old logo on a giant screen. So like seeing it there, and you can see it's all grainy and everything because it's like the classic New Line logo. So it's like, oh yeah, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles about to start.
Exactly. that's the first thing I think about too. Yeah.
Someone should yell Mortal Kombat out loud. That would be great. all the New Line catchphrases.
Right.
All right. Well, that's been our review for Nickel Boys. That's going to do it for this bonus episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can find our show everywhere you can find podcasts. We're on all the socials. We're on all the interwebs areas of where podcasting happens. Abe and I are also on all the socials and everything. You know how our show is.
Yeah, we're online.
Yeah, you can check out the show notes and find all the links and everything that you want to there, including my review of Nickel Boys, which I'm actually quite happy with. I tend to be happy with my reviews because I rate them, but like, hey, I thought that I did a pretty good job on the Nickel Boys review that I wrote for this one. So
great.
Yeah, that's gonna do it for this bonus episode. Ideally we will have a Brutalist episode coming out soon enough as well.
Right.
And then after that will be our top 10 films of 2024.
Bum, bum, bum.
Which last year I was checking Abe to see last year how we did the show. It was a whopping 3 hours and 6 minutes. I think we should top that.
I was like, oh, we got to cut down 30 minutes. Like, no, we should go 320.
We should stretch that shit out. That's what I say.
What are we, the Academy Awards?
people can press pause. Like, that's not a problem. I like the idea of being like, look, there's more show? Great. Like, I'll listen to it later.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we were saying.
It's pause. That's what pause is for.
I'll take 1 week to listen to your top 10 episodes.
I do that on podcasts. I take a week to listen to certain episodes of things. I don't have time to watch, listen to stuff all day.
It's just true. Yeah, I listen throughout the course of a day.
But yeah, that's going to do it for this bonus Out Now with Aaron and Abe. So yeah, until next time, so long.
And goodbye.